Subcommittee on Judiciary, May 6, 1985. Public hearing, Subcommittee 1. Bills to be considered are Senate Bills 176, 226, 418, 426, 573A. For public hearing and possible work session, House Bill 2711. For work session, 2873, 2875. And in the evening, for work session, House Bills 2795, 2939, and 2743.
Please. We're beginning on our first heavy round of Senate bills. We've got a few House bills also. It's my intent to follow our agenda as printed, with a couple of exceptions. But we're pleased to have Senator Walt Brown here to speak with us about Senate Bill 573. And members should have before them a letter addressed to Senator Brown from the State Forester. Part of the documents here. Senator Brown.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman and colleagues. If you'll take a look at the A. Gross 573, I think I can explain to you the thrust of the measure. Let me say, first of all, that the genesis of this particular bill was from the Department of Forestry back in 1979. At the time that audits by former Secretary of State Norma Paulus indicated a substantial problem of theft from state forests, both the common school lands and the county trust lands. But this problem that was much publicized in the press in 1979 has been an increasing problem on industrial forest and on small woodland holdings until this current biennium. There has been congressional appropriations through the U.S. Department of Agriculture for what is called a cooperative program of law enforcement against timber theft. For example, Lane County has a full-time deputy sheriff whose salary actually is paid for by the large industrial timber companies and by the U.S. Department of Agriculture to oversee theft problems on public, federal, and on private holdings. There are several ways of tightening up the law, and we tried to do that in the Agriculture Committee. And if you take a look at the A. Gross bill, you'll see that what we did, first of all, was we added deciduous trees to the current law. At the present time, there's a requirement for having some sort of cutting permit or other documentary evidence of title or possession when you're moving wood products down the highway in a truck. The current law just talks in terms of five coniferous trees. We beef that up to put in deciduous trees like quick alder is probably the one that is most stolen because of its value as lumber wood, but madrone is also valuable for purposes of firewood. And then the problem is when they don't take a whole tree, they take a log. What about that? So we also beefed up the statute to put in logs there on line 16 of the A. Gross. Then, having kind of looked at the subject of the possible theft, we looked at the basic statute, which talks in terms of currently a document of title, or it also talks in terms of a document of sale. The problem is when a contract log hauler is moving logs, he doesn't really have title because he doesn't really own it. And he oftentimes hasn't purchased it. He's simply moving the logs down the highway, either for the owner of the forest who's moving the logs out to market, or for the loaner, the owner of the mill that has purchased the logs. At the federal level, there's always a requirement that a contract log hauler have some document, bill of lading or trip ticket in the cab, showing that this load of logs has not in effect been stolen, is properly in the possession of the truck driver. And for the sale of state timber, the contract requires generally that those who move state timber have a documentation of ownership. But when we're talking about privately owned timber, there is no such requirement. This bill on line 17 requires that the trucker have some other documentary evidence of ownership. Now, who is accepted from the statute? And there are exceptions. If you turn over to the back, you see some of these exceptions. First of all, the transportation of trees with root intact. Typically, if people are stealing trees, they're not going out with a big hydraulic wedge and removing the tree with roots. That's something that is done only for purposes of transplanting. The B category is another exception. Basically, if you're moving your own logs, the moving of coniferous or deciduous trees or logs by the owner of the land, you don't have to show that you're the owner. How does an owner of land produce documentary evidence that he owns it? He can't give himself a bill of sale. He doesn't have a document of title. He write a note to himself. You're for your friend, you're the owner, but that doesn't make much sense. So there's the exception that's currently in the law. We've just beefed it up to include deciduous trees and logs. And also we made it clear that it also applies to the employee of the owner. Now, if it's an agent of the owner, like a contract log hauler, then they've got to have some documentation. This just brings our current law in line with the federal practice and with the practice of sales of timber from state lands. Thank you. Passed without dissent, any vote on the Senate floor.
Thank you, Senator. Are there any questions? Representative Kopetsky.
Yes, good afternoon, Senator Brown.
Good afternoon, Mike.
What would be a probable cause to stop for a police officer, I guess, somebody carrying a load of trees?
I think if the truck is has a big sign like a Weyerhaeuser, that would not be probable cause because it would look like they're moving their own timber. But I think any sort of a private contract log hauler could be subject to be checked just to see that he's got some documentation. And I think normal working day time is not probably going to be the usual thing, but most of the timber thefts occur on weekends and in the evening hours. We recently had a timber theft in Clackamas County of county timber. $500,000 was removed from 30 acres over a period of months. And to do that takes some real operation and real talent, but it I think, you know, it's just going to be the suspicious circumstances.
And Mr. Chair.
Representative Kopetsky.
Are we talking about just logs, or would it include firewood?
No, there's a separate provision on firewood that was passed a couple of sessions ago, and this doesn't deal with that.
81 session, despite Representative Bradford's eloquent arguments against it. Yeah. Reference to the pioneer with the axe, we passed that.
We're talking about full trees, you know, essentially the full length tree or cut up trees, but not firewood. And we are talking about Christmas trees also here.
Representative Kopetsky?
Normally, Senator, would these logs have a brand on them?
Federal government requires that logs be painted and branded on both ends. The state contracts require branding, and there's a requirement in state law that three logs out of every load be branded on one end. This bill does not require an enhancement of the current branding requirement until about 1977 or 78, 77. There was a requirement for full branding of all laws. But the problem is, as we've lost our old growth and got down to second growth, it's become not a problem with just branding three trees, but branding 30 sometimes, a lot of poles. So they backed off on the branding requirement. Only three have to be branded per load. And because of the limp branding requirement now, this basically substitutes some reasonable documentation. Nothing is specifically required other than documentary evidence of ownership.
Thank you.
Representative Peterson?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Brown, I apologize for coming in late, and you may have already spoken to this issue, but is the reason deciduous trees are included now is because there was no restriction before and people were cutting a great many deciduous trees down and illegally?
The market is essentially for the deciduous or the softwood tree. That becomes the studs and the plywood. And only in recent years has alder, for example, or hemlock found a market in Oregon. We are just recently now seeing in Oregon the formation of an Oregon Hardwood Wood Products Association. And we've now just recently discovered that alder is valuable for furniture, and hemlock is valuable for the overhead sheeting of open beamed homes. And so now really hardwood's becoming the object of theft. And because of the pressure on the pulp market, as we ship out logs overseas, and they're not shipped out as cans, we're losing that pulp potential that's in the quadrants of the four sides. And so there's a real pressure now to steal hardwood for purposes of pulp.
Hmm. Any further questions? If not, thank you very much, Senator.
Thank you very much.
That's it for those who signed up to testify on 573. Is there anyone else here on 573? Okay, if not, we'll return to our normal agenda. Howard, let me inquire. Ms. Hayes, you're here for 426, is that correct? I know you've got more than enough to keep you busy back at your office. Why don't we go ahead and allow you the opportunity to testify on that bill? Senate Bill 426.
Thank you, Representative. I am Hazel G. Hayes, and I'm chairman of the Oregon Board of Parole. I am here today in support of Senate Bill 426, and Judge Frank DeRodwin, who is the chairman of the parole board of the Advisory Commission on Prison Terms and Parole Standards, has asked me also to testify on his behalf. He's unable to attend today. To House Judiciary from F.J. DeRodwin, I apologize for not being able to appear in person, but I have motion day on May 6th. And I am unable to reschedule all of the matters set for May 6th. I've asked Hazel Hayes to appear for any questions you may have regarding Senate Bill 426. Senate Bill 426 will not affect the current parole matrix or its application by the parole board or by the Advisory Commission on Prison Terms and Parole Standards, or as 144, 775, and 785. Senate Bill 426 will address the philosophical differences which have surfaced in the past and may surface in the future. These differences, in my view, have been time-consuming and disruptive in determining how to approach our legislative duties as contained in ORS 144780. Let me explain. I've been on the Parole Advisory Commission since its formation in 1977. One view which has been often expressed is that the Parole Advisory Commission will establish appropriate ranges of duration of imprisonment without regard to limitations imposed by existing correctional facilities or services. The other view, which is currently the majority view, is that the Parole Advisory Commission will establish appropriate ranges of duration of imprisonment, but will also recognize reality. That is, we will also recognize the practical limitations imposed by existing correctional facilities and services. In essence, the first view says we will do our job, and then it's up to the legislative and executive branches to provide sufficient correctional facilities and services. The present majority view is that we will do our job, taking into account what the legislative and executive branches are able to provide in the way of correctional facilities and services. The purpose of this proposed legislation is thus not to change the criteria to be applied in ongoing formation and application of the parole matrix, or to overemphasize the appropriate consideration of existing correctional resources by, for instance, incorporating such consideration as an objective under ORS 14780 sub 2. This bill is simply designed to say once and for all that we cannot ignore existing correctional resources when carrying out our tasks assigned to the Parole Advisory Commission. That is Judge Girardin's testimony. He says that I will answer any questions you may have. I prefer answering them as it relates to my own testimony. I am on the advisory commission.
Okay, well, why don't we hear your statement, then we'll take questions.
Thank you.
Ms. Hayes.
Senate Bill 426 will not affect the parole board's current matrix. However, I feel that it could push the board to more closely follow its guidelines. As an example, is that a number of inmates are sentenced with a minimum per ORS 144110. Often the minimum is more than double the range. However, the board has total discretion in deciding whether to sustain the minimum. The statute being written as it is, the board has not felt the necessity to establish guidelines in determining when to sustain the minimum. This is particularly noticeable in crime categories 1 through 4 and does affect the prison population. The board presently is sensitive to overturning minimums. With the passage of Senate Bill 426, the board would be less subject to criticism. Also, the board has not had any indication that it is expected to consider correctional resources in making decisions. If this is made a responsibility in the decision making, the board would accept it, then I would expect the board to, one, more carefully consider minimums in making decisions, and two, carefully consider just where in the range to set the prison term. In crime categories 1 through 3, there is a maximum variation of up to 10 months. And I have Exhibit C attached for you to notice that. Finally, the board does unanimously support Senate Bill 426.
Thank you, Ms. Hayes. Are there any questions? Rep. St. Peterson?
Thank you. I'm not totally familiar with the matrix system, and I wonder if you could explain to me. Now, the minimum, I presume, means the minimum sentence. Now, could you explain the range also, how the minimum and the range work together?
When the judges set a sentence for 20 years, then by statute he can say that under the proper number, you will serve one half of that 10 years. Mm-hmm. The statute is written to say that the board can overturn that minimum by 4 votes. It's, even though we get a majority, it is usually not 4 votes when it's time that when we look at overturning it, it's usually 3-2. Therefore, the minimum stays in place. If the range is 24 months.
Now, what do you mean range?
The guidelines. The board uses guidelines.
Okay.
If the guidelines call for a maximum of 24 months, or even to say a maximum of 60 months, and there's a 10-year minimum, two votes can keep the board from overturning that, and it's twice the guidelines it leaves. The board has not, because the statute is written to give the board that kind of discretion, the board has not found it necessary to develop guidelines. I've urged guidelines be developed, but the board has not taken that on. There's been an awful lot, I think we should face the fact there's been a lot of criticism of the board in overturning minimums. We sometimes pick up the paper and the judge says, well, you know, how dare they overturn that minimum? I knew I wanted him to serve 10 years. The board, I suppose I could say, feels the wounds of the criticism. Mm-hmm. Or some members of the board.
Further questions? If not, thank you very much, Ms. Hayes.
Thank
appreciate you.
You
coming over and sharing your comments and Judge Uragwan's with us. Paul Snyder.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the subcommittee. I'm Paul Snyder, representing the Oregon Jail Overcrowding Project. The Jail Overcrowding Project has endorsed Senate Bill 426 with the understanding that it's necessary to realize and take account for the fact that prisons are crowded, as the matrix has said. I think it's common practice now that when the parole board sets the matrix, it indirectly considers these costs and this basically codifies something that's already in practice. The caveat that the Jail Overcrowding Project would have is that we need to also be concerned about jail overcrowding in the process. Sure, that's all I have.
Okay. Any questions for Mr. Snyder? If not, thanks very much. That's it for those who had signed up to testify on 426. Are there any individuals here who didn't sign up? Ms. Luther, welcome.
Mr. Chairman, thank you. I'm Diane Luther, staff for the Oregon Prison Overcrowding Project, who submitted the bill and substituting for Bob Watson and Jack Dolan, apparently, since they're not here. Wanted to explain that 426 was submitted by a member of our board, Judge Frank Uragwan from Eastern Oregon, and he is the chair of the Advisory Commission on Parole Standards and feels strongly that they would like to have this piece of legislation so that they can work, have the statutory authority to work with the Corrections Division to help manage the offender population. And the Corrections Division has also indicated that they're in support of this bill so that they can work with the Parole Board in this arena. And I'd be happy to answer any questions about the bill.
Okay, thank you. Any questions? Representative Miller?
Would you agree with the previous witness that this merely would codify that which is already in existence?
The parole board informally does consider the availability of correction facilities in making its decisions. We feel that it would strengthen the position of the parole board and the position of the corrections division in trying to do this by doing it publicly and in a way that is authorized. It's hard to say what the impact, whether it would divert from actual practice to a great extent.
Thank you.
Any further questions? If not, thank you, Ms. Luther. Anyone else on 426? Okay, if not, we'll take 126. And our first witness on that is Len Monks from Children's Services Division.
Mr. Chair and committee members, I'm Len Monks. I'm Assistant Administrator of Children's Services Division. I present testimony in Senate Bill 176, which Children's Services Division drafted really for two purposes, and I won't go through a lot of detail because you have my written testimony already, but simply will say it addresses two problems that we're experiencing with the apprehension and return of youngsters who have gone from Hillcrest, McLaren, and our juvenile corrections programs. First of all, in-state, after the last session passed House Bill 2936, most jurisdictions have come to apply that piece of legislation, which was really intended to address pre-adjudicated youngsters. They have been applying that to the Hillcrest and McLaren youngsters out in the community, and it's been difficult to hold these youngsters when they have escaped the training schools. And so one thing this Senate Bill 176 does is states very clearly that that legislation does not apply to the Hillcrest McLaren youngsters. It also tightens up how long youngsters can be held when they're picked up under the circumstance of being a Hillcrest McLaren youngster. If you're in our present statutes, it's unlimited if you read them carefully, but this would narrow it down to 36 hours, which we feel satisfactory to transport back a youngster from the far reaches of the state. The second problem we've encountered is out of state. Many states now require an order of arrest to hold a youngster in their jurisdictions, and since our statutes as presently constituted do not include running away or escaping from our juvenile training schools a criminal offense, we have been unable to issue them an order of arrest number to satisfy that, and we've had youngsters released out of state who have admitted have escaped from our training schools. In one case, it was a youngster who had been for a murder, and so we're concerned about that. And so in our pre-session filing, we submitted this in the form of making it against the law to run away from Hillcrest to McLaren, but later as we got into this and discussed it with the legal rights, juvenile rights people, found a better compromise, and that is not to make it against the law. We don't want to extend the amount of time youngsters have in the system, but instead we discovered that in the adult system, there is an ability for the administrator of the Adult Corrections Division to issue an order of arrest when an inmate doesn't come back from a leave or generally absconds. And so we've simply used that language in this engrossed form you have before you that's passed the Senate to allow the superintendents of Hillcrest and McLaren to issue an order of arrest when a youngster is out of state if that jurisdiction so needs to assure the timely return of that youngster. So totally it solves both of those problems and has concurrence of both Children's Services Division and the Juvenile Rights Project. And the juvenile rights people were not able to testify today, but did talk to legal counsel Leslie Hammond, and I think she can verify their support of this bill. That's all I have.
Okay. Any questions for Mr. Monks? If not, thank you very much, sir.
Thank you.
That's it for those who signed up to testify. Counsel, I believe you can relate to us a conversation you had with
Julie McFarland.
Correct.
She came to visit me this morning. She was not going to be able to be here this afternoon. She said the bill as written now, the one in front of you, represents a compromise between the Juvenile Rights Project and the Children's Services Division, and they both support the bill. She supported it as it's written and is comfortable with the compromise that has been reached.
Okay. Anyone else on 176? Representative Kopetsky.
I just, for the work session, I'd like to think about the language reasonable grounds versus probable cause, line 20 and 21 on page 1. And I'd like to get counsel, maybe then, or just curious if anybody else has this power, similar power. Are you breaking new ground? Why there isn't a need to, how difficult is it to go to the DA to, or to the court, I guess, to sign off on this?
All right.
Am I just, I don't know much about this stuff.
Perhaps Mr. Monk still here.
Representative, Mr. Monks may be able to respond to that as well. Unfortunately, it looks like he just disappeared, but perhaps your office or counsel working together can try to ascertain that information from him if it's available.
I'll check with Ms. McFarland, Representative Kopetsky, and see what she says. She's informed me that this bill has seen a number of sessions and they have a lot of research to back it up.
Okay. It appears, Representative, on its face that the existing language now authorizes the superintendent or authorized representative to, quote, apprehend and hold the escapee and absentee, or authorizing a police officer to do that. And the existing language doesn't have reasonable grounds language in it. So from that approach, I don't know how long this existing authority has been on the books or what its background is, but it would appear this is more definite in terms of criteria. It does specify a procedure which apparently is necessary so that this authority can be recognized in an extraterritorial context, as well as eliminating any confusion in state. Okay, any other questions for council before we leave this bill, 176? Okay, if not, Senator Yee has an interest in Senate Bill 418, and she's down in Ways and Means Committee. She's been notified on that bill. We have 226.
Restrain someone.
Let me maybe interject at this point. It's my understanding it's against the law at this time to fire a firearm, discharge a firearm across any public highway. Now, that doesn't say whether or not the highway is occupied or not, or whether there's a vehicle present, but it does prohibit, as a general matter, firing across a public highway because presumably when a person fires in such a manner, it's really impossible to know. The individual may have a visual inspection, but they may not. And that's perhaps the law errs on the side of overcaution. And I would guess maybe the same reason applies to a dwelling. One could try to get at it with occupied dwelling, but then you have a real, maybe an even more difficult problem in terms of how do you determine whether it's occupied or unoccupied. And I guess you come down on the side of caution and you assume that a dwelling. And I think we're referring to a dwelling clearly as a place where it's regular place of habitation, not an outbuilding or a barn, but an actual place of habitation itself.
Well, I have no problems with the bill. I guess that issue was raised at some point, and I mean, I don't think that the situation of a cabin being located out in the woods is the type of situation that this bill was designed to cover, and yet some people presumably could be brought in under it. So that I just raised that, and because it, as far as I remember, it hadn't been addressed.
Well, it's a fair question. I think we may want to reflect further and make sure that the record's clear, and also in terms of our intent, and the full committee are on the floor if that question arises.
Yes, sure.
Representative Kopetsky.
I had raised that, I guess, in the initial hearing, and see, the problem isn't the surroundings of a place like Lake Oswego. The problem is whether it's the northwest area of the state or in eastern Oregon, 200 yards through a thicket is a long way. And, there are a lot of little cabins, just believe it or not, just tucked away in the middle of nowhere, that it takes a four-wheel drive to get there. And people have their cabins there because they want it to take a four-wheel drive to get there, and you're wandering around to the woods hunting, and you may not know that this cabin is there. And, you know, if somebody wanted to get on your case about maybe shooting, discharging your firearm, but, I recognize the law says that it says knowingly or recklessly, and as long as the intent is that recklessly does not mean that you did not circle the wagons and kind of check out every square inch of where you're hunting, and that you know what you're, as long as you know what you're shooting at and know that it's not the broadside of a cabin, that somebody is going to be found guilty under this. Now, was that enough on the record?
That's certainly more than enough for my purposes, Representative Kopetsky. Were there any other questions or discussion on Representative Miller's motion? If not, the clerk will call the roll.
Hill?
Aye.
Leslie?
Aye.
Miller?
Aye.
Peterson?
Aye.
Phillips?
Aye.
Springer?
Aye. Motion's adopted. We're going to take our afternoon recess a little early today. Our two bills that we've got scheduled for work session this afternoon, 2873 and 2875, are both bills in which Representative Carter has a strong interest and has appeared before us earlier. She has a conflict with a prior committee and won't be able to join us until 3:15. And so since we finished our Senate bills a little earlier than we anticipated, we're going to be in recess till approximately 3:15, and I'd ask members to try to return promptly at that time, and we will take up then those bills with Representative Carter present to speak for them and help us as we consider them during work session. So we'll, unless there's any other business at this point, we'll be in recess until 3:15. And please try to return timely. Thank you.
Good luck.
Second, I want to come to order, please.
Our low clubs complete.
Everything is fine in Kaiser. I just checked it out.
Thank you, Representative. We have a full agenda this evening, and we hope to move through it expeditiously. I'd like to take up House Bill 2638 first, because we have several people here who I know have an interest in this. And this bill was reported from committee, but after we had reported it from committee, one of the representatives of the folks who have an interest in this bill had asked that we consider an amendment to it as it relates to the notice or warning that we felt was reasonable or ought to be given when feasible under the circumstances prior to the use of deadly force. And at the request of that individual and the people whom he represents, we have brought the bill back to subcommittee for further work session to consider that amendment and hopefully can act expeditiously upon that and then move it to the floor. Council, I believe members should or may have a copy of that language, and I'll ask members to review their bill file and pull out the last engrossed version, and I'll ask council to read the amendment that's been proposed. And Mr. Hughes, may I ask you to come forward perhaps as the proponent of that amendment in case there are any questions while council reviews that? And if you want to be joined by any other folks, be more than glad to welcome them. Mr. Frost, thank you for coming back. We appreciate your efforts. We know you've got, is it six homicide trials now still pending, or?
Six still pending.
Yes. Mr. Fussner, also, thank you for joining us.
Mr. Chairman, Ted Hughes, representing the Oregon Association of Chiefs of Police and the Oregon Peace Officers Association.
Hold on just a moment. Let's make sure we're working from the same draft here, and then we'll be glad to hear from you.
Okay, all of you have this draft. It's a short draft, and it has between line 23 and 24. You can see some typed-in language where it says deadly physical force may be exercised only when, where feasible, the person upon whom the force is to be used has first been warned to stop engaging in the conduct. My goodness, the typist wasn't very good on this, were they? Justifying its use.
Was that passed out this evening?
It was passed out last Wednesday at full committee. It's the short one. And it doesn't, I believe, have anything up in the right-hand corner to designate it as anything. There you go. And it has the little type right in between 23 and 24. Okay. The language that is being proposed to the committee tonight would read, you'd read deadly physical force may be exercised only when, comma, where feasible, and then you would strike the last three lines. So just draw lines through. It's the person upon whom the force is to be used has first been warned to stop engaging in the conduct justifying its use. You take all of that out, okay? And what you would put in its place would read deadly physical force may be exercised only when, where feasible, some warning has been given. So you have to write in some warning has been given. Now, this is language that reflects the actual language in the U.S. Supreme Court decision. Right after where feasible, it says some warning has been given. The original language that both the subcommittee and the full committee approved was language drafted by Mr. Gruber. And the purpose of the original language was to try and define trying to create a standard by which when a police officer is giving a warning to somebody before they are going to use deadly force against them, try to create some sort of a standard under which the police officers could operate. Because one of the things that was a concern to Mr. Gruber and myself is that if a warning was given and you didn't say anything about what kind of warning or what conduct it went to, the court could then come back against the police officer and say they didn't give a sufficient warning. So the original language was drafted to try to minimize any kind of litigation over what kind of warning. However, I have been advised by a number of folks, particularly in the law enforcement area, that they're quite uncomfortable with that language and would much prefer the Supreme Court language, which would say that where feasible, some warning has been given, and that's the language that's before the committee this evening.
Okay, so let's read the language one more time.
Okay. Deadly physical force may be exercised only when, where feasible, some warning has been given.
Okay. Now, I know there may be some concerns about the rest of the language in the bill, but our purpose is not to reopen that debate because the subcommittee and the committee have reached closure on some of those issues. And the purpose of this opportunity to come back this evening was to address this specific amendment, unless there's some strong feeling otherwise by the subcommittee. So I'd like to focus on that issue and that language that council has identified. Mr. Hughes?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, we appreciate your personal cooperation in pulling the bill back because of the concern of a lot of law enforcement agencies and making this change. And insofar as the Oregon Association Chief of Police and the Oregon Peace Officers Association, that change is agreeable to us, and we will be in support of the legislation. The Attorney General's office and the district attorneys is represented by Mr. Frost. I don't want to put words in their mouth. I think let's hear from them.
I'm sure you wouldn't be able to do that even if you tried,
that's
Mr.
Correct.
Hughes. So.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, if I can just briefly indicate that I believe that the language as it would be changed accurately reflects what the Supreme Court said, and that it does not go beyond what the Supreme Court requires. I would have some concerns that leaving the language the way it is seems to tell the officer what exactly he has to tell the person that he's giving a warning to, and thereby puts a limitation on the officer that isn't warranted given the fact that these situations are going to be very volatile, decisions are going to have to be made very quickly, and the Supreme Court has not told us that the warning has to consist of a specific directive to stop certain activity. And I think we ought to give as much latitude as we can in compliance with the Constitution to officers in that circumstance. That's all I have.
Thank you, Mr. Fester. Mr. Frost?
I'm Jack Frost, Linn County District Attorney. I feel a little in a box, but not terribly so. If I may, the language of the opinion that is appropriate here says, if, where feasible, some warning has been given, having previously in that sentence referred to deadly force. Actually, I don't like the word only in there, but I don't know that the meaning of the statement is any different from what you say in the bill, and as long as the record is made that it is an attempt to reiterate the court's position, as I just stated it from the opinion, then I feel more comfortable about it than if without that comment.
Okay. That, I think, in terms of statement of intent, as it relates to this language, it's our intent to follow as closely as we can the intent of the Supreme Court. And I thank you, gentlemen. I know you put in a lot of time and effort on this, and I appreciate your work with us. And the chair would be prepared to accept an amendment to adopt the language which council has read for us to be proposed as an amendment to House Bill 2630. Representative Phillips?
Well, actually, I have a question before the motion, if possible.
Okay, Representative Phillips?
The language that was read by the DA in Lane County, inserted the word if. Is there a reason why we only win if we're feasible, if we want to follow the Supreme Court to the letter? We wouldn't put that in there. And I'm not sure that it is absolutely necessary or changes the meaning terribly, but then again, it might.
Well, this is pretty carefully crafted, I think, at this point, and I would be a little reluctant. Now, it may be subject to some further discussion. I'd be glad to receive that discussion.
Okay. Well, I just brought that up. I think we'll let that fly where it laid, or flop. And I'd be prepared to move the amendment as
Thank
suggested.
You. Thank you. Representative Phillips moves the amendment to subsection 2, a new subsection 2 proposed to section 1 of the bill, ORS 161.239, which has been read to us and distributed by council. Is there any objection to that amendment? If not, it's adopted. Representative Phillips on the bill.
I'd like to move the bill as amended back to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Okay. Representative Phillips moves House Bill 2638 as amended to the full committee with a due pass recommendation. Is there further discussion? If not, the clerk will call the roll.
Bill?
Aye.
Kandinsky?
Aye.
Miller?
Aye.
Peterson?
Aye.
Phillips?
Aye.
Springer?
Aye. Motion's adopted. Thank you all very much. We know you put a lot of time and effort, and appreciate that very much. Okay. Let's take up 2795 next. Council, if you could introduce that bill to us, please, and also any amendments that may be proposed.
All right. This is a bill that was heard and at an earlier session. I have amendments that have been proposed to the bill ready for you, which I'd like to hand out at this point. The amendments are packaged together. They were actually, the truth of the matter is they were written at different times, and so they all go together. The first two, I believe, were written by the same person. The last one are the amendments that are offered by Mr. Overstreet, who is a representative of the telephone company, and raises a different issue for the committee to consider than the original cable TV bill.
Okay, let me, the first set of amendments bearing the date April 10th, 1985. Who shall we identify as the proponent of those amendments?
I believe they're yours.
Okay, these were prepared with the assistance of Mr. Dewey.
Aye.
Mr. Dewey, are you going to claim parentage of these bills, of these amendments also? Okay. And at the request of Mr. Overstreet, I believe I also requested that draft two amendments be prepared.
Draft three.
Draft three, okay. And Mr. Dewey, you also are claiming some parentage with number two amendments. Okay. Why don't we go through the amendments set by set here? And Mr. Dewey, if you and folks who want to talk to us about amendments one and two want to come forward, we'll be glad to hear from you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mike Dewey, representing the Oregon Cable Communications Association. I do not have a copy of the amendments you have in front of you. It might be useful if I had those.
Oh, yes, of course.
Since you insist.
Well, you're hard to get along with.
This is a bill that you heard earlier that deals with that the cable service and is opposed to going into what the reasons for the bill are. Let me discuss with you proposed amendments as they pertain to the Oregon Cable Communications Association. We I'm not sure how you want to deal with this, but...
Yeah, I think, Mike, I'd ask you to work on a couple of sets of amendments after our first hearing. One of my concerns had to do with the definition part as it relates to... I personally had a question about whether or not we had to deal with vagueness or overbreadth in terms of the language, I think on page 2,
right,
which talked about unlawful distribution of the person knowingly manufactures, imports, does a lot of other things. Any device of any description or any plan or kit designed in whole or in part to facilitate the theft of cable services. And I guess I was concerned that that could include a screwdriver, a pair of pliers. I think I know what you were getting at, but I think that one of my concerns and one that the amendments addressed tries to tighten up that language. Since we're dealing with criminal sanctions, we want to make sure we focus very narrowly. And another amendment I think that I asked that you consider, and I think you have considered, is when we talk about the civil liability, and which is kind of a penalty section, a civil penalty, that we tried, rather than the language suggested in section 6, that we try to track a little bit more closely with the language that now exists under the shoplifting statutes or the efforts to pass a bad check, because personally I felt that the penalties there were probably more appropriate than the penalties that your folks might have originally suggested. So I think those are, at least from my point of view, the things that I had asked you to consider, and I think those are the amendments that are represented in dash 1 and dash 2. And if you want to add some further comments, please feel free.
I would be very happy to. Again, Mr. Chair, dealing with section 3, there was some discussion as to whether or not it might include for example, a screwdriver as the capability to facilitate the theft of cable service. That was not our intent. I don't believe the district attorney would prosecute under that impression. But nevertheless, we have come back with to you with some language that provides any device designed to make available the unauthorized reception of cable television signals, which I believe clarifies that, so we're not talking about a device in whole or in part, but a device that would make available those signals. A screwdriver would not do that. There are other devices such as a converter or the tampering of a converter that would allow for that to occur. So I do believe that narrows the definition, and so we would not have a problem with the types of examples that we pointed out in the last hearing. As it relates to Section 5, and these are the four 1085 amendments, those were presented to you originally as we had the hearing, and the problem we had was we know that people tamper with a device, and from time to time they ask for someone else to tamper with it, and under the original language, there were some that felt that that would not be prosecutable, and so we felt that we needed to strengthen that. So we do have the language 410-85 that deals with a person commits a crime of tampering with cable television equipment if person A knowingly does it themselves, or B knowingly permits another person to do it. And Mr. Chair, again, it's the word knowingly, and you're going to have to prove that. We recognize that. The district attorney is going to have to feel very strong about being able to prosecute under that set of circumstances. And then, Mr. Chair, with regards to the amendments that deal with on that same page, 41085 amendments, lines 18, 19, and 20 of those amendments, we deal with the franchise cable system, or in the language, it said a licensed cable system. And in the state of Oregon, we either franchise cable systems or we permit cable systems, authorize cable systems, but we do not provide for the licensure of cable systems in the state of Oregon. So we wanted to make that very clear that that would not be a technicality somewhere down the road. So we provide for the franchised or duly authorized cable system. And then, Mr. Chair, if you will,
The last set of amendments, the Dewey Amendments 42985, deal with the civil penalties, and we have agreed to basically strike most of Section 6 and then provide for the penalties that come in line with 30.875 that deal with an adult or an emancipated minor or an unemancipated minor, and how that fits into the statute. We have no problem with that because it does give us the opportunity to secure damages, and let me tell you that from time to time the damages can be fairly substantial, and also to provide for a penalty. And what I mean by damages, there are cases from time to time where you have converters that are being sold, and you can get up into the thousands and thousands of dollars. And again, it's a civil remedy. We think it's important to have a civil remedy as well as a criminal remedy. So, Mr. Chair, those are the amendments that we present to you this evening.
Okay, well, for purposes of discussion, let me go ahead and place a motion, and if I may, on both of the amendments, and then we'll go ahead and take discussion, skip, and comment and action on those two amendments. The chair would move the committee amend the bill as printed by adoption of the amendments noted as Legislative Council House Bill 2795-1, bearing the date April 10, 1985, and also the adoption of the amendments also bearing the designation Legislative Council 2795-2, and bearing the date April 29, 1985. Both of which Mr. Dewey and I have worked on to refine the bill and put it in a form that I think is compatible with existing law, and I think accomplishes the purpose that brought the bill before us in the first place. And appreciate very much your help and cooperation, Mr. Dewey. And had a chance to review these with one of the co-sponsors, Representative Miller, and I hope they meet his approval. Is there further discussion on the amendments? Okay, I see two thumbs up. Representative Peterson.
Mr. Chair, just some clarification. Now, we're leaving out part of Section 6 and substituting the amendments. Are we leaving out one subsection A and B?
Actually, if you on line 7 of the second set of amendments, you see that we're deleting lines 18 through 28, which means we're taking out all of Section 6. And we are adopting the amendments that are stated basically in a new Section 6. And again, Mr. Dewey, I know you've had a chance to review these pretty carefully, and again, they accomplish the purpose that was the reason for the bill being introduced.
Yes, Mr. Chair, we wanted to have the opportunity for a civil remedy, and it still provides for a civil remedy, and one of the concerns we had is that people would look at it from the standpoint of, well, my fine is not going to be very substantial, I'm going to continue to be in business, and we think this still provides the opportunity to collect damages that would be substantial, actual damages. So we think it does what needs to be done in this particular section.
Okay. Thank you. Is there further discussion? Comment? Is there any objection to the amendments? If not, they're adopted. Let's, at this point, I guess, Mike, if you want to remain up there, that's fine, but the next set of amendments are those that Mr. Overstreet has brought to us.
Mr. Chair, I'm not involved
okay.
in those amendments, so I will.
Okay. I guess we should ask, have you had a chance to look at those amendments, or are you familiar with them generally in terms of what they propose
Mr.
to
Chair,
do?
Mr. Chair, I saw these amendments this afternoon. If the committee wants to move on these amendments, I don't have any problem. It would just be... obviously, we're starting to get a little later in the session, and as I told Mr. Overstreet, it is my concern that we get this piece of legislation moving as quickly as possible, because there is another body to deal with, and he recognizes that. So I would hope that you could act in some speedily fashion
one way or the other. But I am not involved in those amendments, and I've had an opportunity to look at them, but I'm not, computer crime is not something I know very much about.
Okay, let me, thank you, Mike, if you want to,
thank you,
I guess, retreat to the front row there. Dave, why don't you come on out? Let me, just for the committee's background and for information of those who may be here have an interest in this bill, we had about 2 or 3 weeks ago, at the request of AEA, American Electronics Association, we did introduce a bill, or we gave permission to introduce a bill and to have it prepared through LC, had to do with computer hacking. And members may or may not recall that. We got that to the point that the end of last week, it came back from LC for my signature. And at that point, representatives of AEA, who had originally asked us to introduce the bill, backed off and said, we don't think we need to go ahead with this legislation at this time. And so that bill was not dropped. So though at one time it appeared there might be a vehicle for the computer problem hacking, unless we decide to go ahead and drop that bill, which it's still within our authority to do so, this, it appears, and Mr. Overstreet can correct me if I'm wrong, it appears this bill may be one of the few that relate somewhat to this subject. So I believe that's the reason that Dave approached our committee and council and asked us to consider these amendments. So this is one option. Another option could be to introduce that bill, actually drop it with a chief clerk from AEA, and possibly consider these amendments in that context. So those are the options as I see them at this point. But I, with that introduction, I want to allow Mr. Overstreet to speak to his amendments, which we had asked to be prepared at his request. Dave?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Dave Overstreet. I'm the governmental affairs manager with General Telephone Company of the Northwest here in the state of Oregon. We are this evening proposing amendments to House Bill 2795 specifically to deal with the problem of computer crime or computer hackers, if you will. It's a problem that is on the rise throughout the country, including the state of Oregon. What we are proposing, as you will see from Amendments 2795-3, that we would like to see computer crime become a felony in the state of Oregon. That is the bottom line of this bill.